Good morning, everyone, and thank you so much for joining us for SPIRIT, the stimulating program initiative for retirees that inspires thought. I'm Judy Steinig, Senior Director of the OU's Department of Community Projects and Partnerships and coordinator and host for SPIRIT. The OU started SPIRIT several years ago as an on-site program, and now we're happy to present it as an online program for retirees, not yet retirees, baby boomers, empty nesters, sandwich generation, and parents, and seniors, everyone who is looking for educational, intellectual, and spiritual growth. Since the beginning of the pandemic, SPIRIT continues to be a safe and ideal way for everyone to connect and learn together in a virtual setting. Today, we have a very unique and fascinating program. Our topic is Behind the Scenes, how the OU has spearheaded the preservation of the Masorah of kosher birds. I am joined here at OU headquarters, 11 Broadway in New York City, by our presenter, my colleague, Rabbi Chaim Loike, who is a rabbinical coordinator at the Orthodox Union, an adjunct professor at Lander College for Women, and a certified shochet. He has brought with us a number of live birds that are right here with us. Before I turn the Spirit Forum over to him, I want to acknowledge the presence of Rabbi Eli Eleth, Managing Director of OU Kosher, and thank him for arranging this presentation, which is sponsored by the Harry Barron Ask OU Outreach Program. I'd also like to thank the OU staff, Alex Cook, Anthony Lugo, and our department admin, Allison Papira, for their assistance in preparing this program. It is my pleasure and honor to turn the Spirit Forum over to Rabbi Loike and his friends.
Thank you, Revitzin Steinig. Thank you for giving me the opportunity. Of course, I have to also say thank you to the ASCO-U and to, of course, Alex Cook for everything he's doing. If it goes well, it's all him. If it doesn't, you know what I'm saying. I also wanted to thank Rabbi Elif for all the work he did to put everything together, and Rabbi Ganak for allowing us to do the research, which we'll talk about, and of course, Rabbi Elephant also for his support. First things first, there's a side motivation that the OU as a kosher organization had to do this presentation. We noticed that during the pandemic, many people started raising chickens in their backyard, and people assumed that anything that was sold to them as a chicken is a chicken. And they also didn't recognize that sometimes when things happened in the backyard, something like the raccoons getting in or rats, that it presented serious trafis issues. We're not going to address the trafis issues, but as a matter of public concern, we're going to, say that if you notice that a chicken's injured, you do have to ask a competent rabbi before you eat the eggs. But we will address the identification of kosher chickens, and hopefully you'll be better learned in how to identify the chickens in your backyard or chickens in general. I want to, now that we have the Zoom up, I want to recognize the presence of my mother-in-law, Elaine Jay, who has joined us on Zoom. And it's good to see her, and to all the people in Boynton Beach who are being supportive by joining us here, thank you. When we talk about kosher birds, it's very different than when we talk about kosher mammals, when we talk about kosher fish, and when we talk about kosher insects. In the Torah, it identifies specific signs through which kosher animals, kosher fish, and kosher insects can be identified. Although the Gemara in Chul and Daf Nun Tes does have specific anatomical features by which kosher birds can be identified, the Torah does not identify any physical traits by which the kosher and the non-kosher birds can be identified. Instead, there's two lists, one in Sefer Vayikra Perek Yud Aleph, one in Sefer Devarim Perek Yud Dalet, and those two lists cumulatively identify all the non-kosher birds. Any bird not indicated on the non-kosher bird list by default is going to be kosher. So technically speaking, depending on how you count, you have 24 species and species groups that are forbidden, and any bird that's not associated with that is kosher. This would make this presentation very fast, because all we have to do is know what's not kosher, and everything else is fine. Unfortunately, The Jewish people no longer have the ability to identify the 24 non-kosher birds, and as a result, even in the time of the Gemara, and certainly by the time of the Rishonim, the tradition has emerged that we only eat birds if we know that they're kosher. So everything's gone full circle. In the past, by process of elimination, any bird that wasn't known to be non-kosher, the default would be it's kosher. And now, the way we paskin is if we don't know that the bird is kosher, we have to avoid it because we're scared it might be not kosher. And we have a very short list of birds that we can identify as kosher, and those are the only birds that we traditionally will consume. Of course, the most kosher of all the birds, the Gemara's words, not mine, is going to be the pigeon, the yonah. The yonah, along with the turtle dove, were brought as korbanos in the Beis HaMikdash, and they're kosher. We have here a yonah, just one second. We have it, this one. Most of the birds I will not put on the podium, but this one we can. This is a yonah. I don't know if we can zoom in on it. It's a pigeon. For those of you that live in New York or any other place where there are pigeons, pigeons are not the most exotic bird that we have here. And this pigeon anatomically is identical to a regular pigeon. The only difference with this specific pigeon is that it has colors which are a bit unique, not colors that you wouldn't find on a regular street pigeon, just the way the colors are arranged on this pigeon. You see the beautiful coloration of its head, something you're not gonna find in a normal street pigeon, but everything else about this pigeon is just a regular pigeon. Nobody would have a problem consuming this pigeon. This pigeon is, of course, kosher. The problem that we have, even with a bird as simple as the pigeon, is that ornithologists, those are people who study birds, have identified over 300 species of pigeons. And just to be clear, there are two terms I'm going to use. One is species, one is breed. Species usually means that they're not able to breed with each other. While as ironically, breeds mean that they're basically the same kind of bird, but they look different. So you have 300 species of pigeon, they don't breed with each other, and we're not really sure how to identify them. But even within the regular street pigeon, you have some very unique birds. Okay. We have here a pigeon, which if you look, you'll notice a little bit dirty. Just a second, I want to just calm it down. But it has so many feathers on its feet that if it was flying, it would look like it has four wings instead of two. And if you also look at the pigeon, I'm going to put it down, but hopefully, well, it might be a mistake. No, it's not going to let me. Okay. Anyways, it's good to see it, right? And you see that this pigeon looks a lot less like the other pigeon that we have here. And we'll put them together. They actually... Okay. And you could see how similar the pigeons are, but also very different. And the distinction between the pigeons is much more dynamic than the distinction between different species, even though these two pigeons are both pigeons and they'll breed together. Now, of course, when you look at these pigeons, most people could see similarities, you could see differences. However, as we get to other birds that were more subjected to domestication, we're going to see that it suddenly becomes very difficult for us to identify the species. And we're going to come back to that in one second. We have over here one of the easiest birds to identify. That little bird over there is a quail, a Slav. And this quail, the Slav, probably the bird that the Jews ate in the Midbar, although it is a debate among the Rishonim, the exact species. That quail is an easy bird to identify because of all the birds in the world that are similar to it, there's really no bird that looks exactly like it, and the species itself has many different color strains, but the species looks like this. This is how they tend to look. You see a bird like this, the same size, same behaviors, chances are that it's a regular quail. And there are two quail that look like this. One is the Japanese quail, one is the European quail, and we accept both of them as kosher. Okay. We have another kind of bird, which I only have in the taxidermied form. And just to be clear, all the birds that I have here are real. Some are alive, some are not, no longer alive. But the OU is very makbid not to kill any birds for the presentation. So in case anyone's concerned, these birds are either they were killed one way or another 50, 60 years ago and they were purchased on eBay, or they died naturally. And after their natural death, they were preserved. What we have here are two different kinds of partridges, a gray partridge and a red partridge. And this, red-legged partridge. And these two partridges are both accepted as kosher. However, there are a number of other birds that look very similar to them. And unlike the quail, which is sort of in a class by itself, meaning gathers in large flocks, migrates across the Mediterranean, if a strong wind might blow it into the desert where the Bedouins can just collect it. You know, very biblically, very similar to the way it's been for at least the time since Yetzias Mitzrayim, the partridges are very different from country to country. And unlike the quail, which, as Marco Polo said, the world seems to be very different except the quail, not a direct quote because I don't speak Italian, but the quail are the same everywhere. The partridges tend to be very different. And one of the shilas that we had with, let's say, this partridge is this partridge that we have over here is called a chukar partridge. And the chukar partridge is found in many parts of Europe. There were other parts of Europe where they have an almost identical partridge called a red-legged partridge. There's also what's called a Barbary partridge and a Filby partridge. And what we, the communities that accepted one partridge were unaware of the other partridge. And what the Rabbanim have to figure out is that are these partridges different species, in which case each one has a very small Mesorah, or are all the partridges the same, in which case there's a large universal Mesorah. In any case, we do accept the Hungarian partridge, the gray partridge, and the red-legged partridges as kosher. However, unlike the quail, where there are no similar birds, there are a number of species which appear very similar to the partridges. And without being familiar with the identification of the partridges, you have to be careful not to eat one unless you are certain that what you're eating is indeed one of the kosher partridges. Okay. Now, we also have a number of birds which the Mesorah is still being debated. I can't say that the bird's not kosher. I can't say it is kosher. It's at best, some say yes, some say no. One of those birds is a ringneck pheasant. There's ample evidence if you look in the older Shilos and Tshuvos, specifically if you look at the Mesorah of Livorno, where they not only wrote the names, but they also drew pictures of the birds which they accepted as kosher. The pheasant was listed as one of the birds that was accepted as kosher. And there's ample evidence there were many communities which accepted the pheasant as kosher. However, we have a problem with the pheasant, and this gets into the key issue that we deal with whenever we try to establish a Mesorah. The way that we know that the pigeon and the quail are kosher is because we have what's called a Mesorah. A Mesorah means that a rabbi who is knowledgeable of the species and is also knowledgeable of nature in general and halacha said, I know that this bird is kosher, and my Rebbe taught me that it's kosher. So, of course, the pigeons were very easy to keep the Mesorah, because anyone who lives anywhere in Europe, the United States, all over the world, they're pigeons. And anyone who is learning shchit, anyone who's learning the halachos of kosher birds, their Rebbe would tell them, the pigeon is the yonah mentioned in the Torah, the pigeon is kosher. Similarly, the quail, because it was migratory, and it migrated from North Africa, partially through Israel, and dispersed throughout Eastern Europe, the communities were able to know, rabbi to student, that these birds are kosher. With the pheasant, even though there's evidence that it's kosher, since there was no rabbi to student lineage that has been completely preserved, the evidence is not alone, is not sufficient, because we don't have the rabbi to student communication where they said, this bird was permitted to me by my Rebbe, who was a shocheder, who knew nature. So there are some people who feel that we do have ample evidence that the pheasant is kosher, and there are other people who are not as certain. Rav Moshe Feinstein, Zichrono Livracha, wrote a tshuva about it. He wasn't certain whether or not the Misora exists. I cannot chas v'chalila say that the pheasant is not a kosher bird. I would say the evidence, and you can look this up on your own, the evidence is there that it was accepted as a kosher bird, but we don't rely on evidence alone. We also rely on the Misora, which is a rabbi-to-student tradition that this bird is kosher. Okay. Now, after I said that we don't rely on evidence, there is one case where the majority of the Rabbanim did rely on evidence. And that is, if he'll cooperate. Hope you got that on camera. Shh. If he can get his footing, he'll be calm. Otherwise, okay. Shh. All right, little entertainment. Okay, this is a goose. This goose is actually, it actually does like me. I've had it since it was an egg, and it's imprinted on me. Unfortunately, I don't know why it's not behaving. Okay, the goose is unique, because if you look at the beak up, it's trying to give me whatever. You look at, okay, shh. If you look at the foot of the goose, Alex, can we get a zoom in on the foot? And if you look at the beak of the foot, of the goose, yeah, he's just gonna put it down for a second. Shh. Okay. All right. Can we got him on the camera? Okay. If you look at the goose, you'll notice that the goose's anatomical features, its foot and its beak, prevent it from doing something which is very halachically problematic. This goose is not able to tear. The goose actually, if it didn't like me, it could bite very hard. It could crush, but it can't tear. And we have a tradition that none of the kosher birds are what's called dorsim. They tear other birds. This goose, because with its feet, it lacks talons, so it can't dig in and tear. And because its beak is constructed, it's not hooked. Look how flat its beak is. It cannot tear its meat. That any bird which has a goose-like beak and a goose-like foot, even if it's not a goose, would be kosher. This idea is brought lahalacha by the Shulchan Aruch. It's also brought lahalacha by the Rosh, the Tur, but that's not surprising if the Rosh, his father, said so. It's also brought by the Razor of Zerachia Halevi, also known as the Baal Hamor. It's quoted in the name of Rabbeinu Chananel, and many of the other Rishonim hold from this tradition that no bird that has that kind of a foot and that kind of a beak could be a predator. Which means that unlike the other birds that we have here, if you have some uncertainty regarding a bird that looks like a goose, there is a lot of room to be lenient. The tradition of the Ashkenazim since the time of the Rama was not to be lenient, but it's very clear that the older Ashkenaz Rabbanim were all lenient, and there were many machlokesim in the Ashkenaz community that developed in the 1800s regarding this. But as a general rule, any bird that has a duck-like, goose-like beak, goose-like foot, cannot be a predator. And if it has the proper anatomical features, we can investigate and assume it's kosher. Again, not how we paskin now, but that was the psak of the early Ashkenazim. And it's still something that we generally, if we are in a bind, we can rely on to investigate the kosher status. With the other birds, we have no such leniency, which means the only way we know they're kosher is if we have a Misora, if we have a tradition, rabbi to student, stating that it's kosher. Okay. Now with that in mind, and you'll forgive me, I'm not gonna put the goose away because he seems happy there. What we do at the OU, and this is the other half of the presentation, is we try to investigate and document the kashrus of the birds that we certify. Now the first thing that we do is very often when we make presentations, this is over Zoom, but in person, we have all the birds in the presentation. We'll have pictures and little boxes here. And a lot of times, Rabbanim who are familiar with the birds or older Shoichtim, they come to the presentations and we ask them to sign off on birds that they knew were kosher. So this way we have collected a portfolio of rabbis who not only theoretically know the bird of kosher, but who in the previous generation, in the 60s and the 50s, they were shechting and eating these birds. Some of the birds which are more relevant to the kosher market, we not only collect the signatures, but we also produce detailed albums of all the anatomical features of these kosher birds, so that if there's any question as to what bird was consumed 40, 50 years ago, or the birds that we're certifying today, we have it all documented in tremendous, you can see how thick these books are, tremendous detail. Every part of the bird is documented so that we know not only what birds we're eating today, but what birds were consumed in the previous generation. With that introduction, one of the biggest controversies that we have and the problem that we have comes to the chickens. The chickens are a little bit different than the other birds for two reasons. First of all, the identification of a, we'll call it the original chicken, is at best theory, and it's certainly not fact. Which means we don't know what is the perfect chicken, what is the chicken that people, you know, the precise chicken that was being consumed 2,000 years ago. The other side of the coin is that because of the amount of money that people can make by having a chicken that is either producing more eggs or producing better meat, there have been hundreds and hundreds of breeds of chickens which have been developed. And these breeds of chicken look very different. And I want to show you that, and then we'll discuss what we do at the OU to determine what's kosher. So just, I don't know if we can, should I move the table or? So if you look over here, you can see that we have two chickens, one of which is a what's called a Rhode Island Red, and the other one is called a Plymouth Rock. The Plymouth Rock is barred, which means it has white and black stripes, and the Rhode Island Red, as the name implies, is red. These were the two chickens that were accepted as kosher and were the most widely consumed in the United States in the 50s and 60s. These chickens, if you look at them, you can see they're pretty similar to each other. The basic construction of their beak, their basic construction of their feet is similar. And of course, the coloration of the feathers is different, which is not a tremendous problem for the kashrus of the bird, but it's something to recognize that these birds are mainly differentiated, if you look at them, by the colors, and not so much by their anatomical features. If we look at this chicken, which is much more cooperative than the goose, you'll notice that unlike the goose, the beak of this chicken is hooked. And of course, if you take a look at the chicken leg, you also know that it has, instead of the goose, which has a webbed foot, which means all the toes are sort of united, the chicken feet are not webbed, which means that a chicken, not that it will, but theoretically, it's much closer to being an animal that can tear other animals. In fact, what I used to do, but I stopped because they made a mess, was I used to bring my leftovers from Shabbos to my presentations, and I'd put it in a cage with chickens, and the chickens would eat the chicken. And you could have a large carcass if it's cooked. Raw doesn't work as well, but if they have a large carcass of a chicken, they'll eat it. And they have their beak, they can tear off the meat, and with their feet, they don't use their feet, but theoretically their feet, if you look at the chicken foot, is similar to the foot that you would find among predators. Now, before we get people nervous that chickens are problematic, we all accept chickens as kosher. And Rashi and Tosos have two separate definitions of what a predator is. And both of them indicate that there's no problem with the chicken, but by looking at the chicken, you wouldn't know that. You'd only know that by observing the chicken. According to Rashi, a predator uses its foot to keep the food in place. Chickens don't eat with their feet. So even though their feet look like a bird that they could use their feet, they don't. So they don't behave like a predator, although their foot is much more similar to a predator's foot than a goose. The other way that we understand a predator is Rabbeinu Tam. And Rabbeinu Tam says a predator takes bites out of living organisms. Chickens don't do that. They'll swallow a bug whole. They'll be happy to run after a bug and eat it if it's the kind that they like to eat. geese parenthetically can swallow fish whole, but the chicken is not going to run up to a living organism and start taking bites out of it. For those of you that watch National Geographic or have observed the ospreys in Boynton Beach, what you'll see is that when they collect fish from the ocean, the fish is still squirming and they'll take bites out of the fish while it's still alive. That is the action of a predator. A chicken will not take bites out of an animal that's still alive. So even though the chicken is similar, I didn't say identical, similar to a predator, its anatomical features might be similar, but its behavior is in no way predatory, and there's no halachic problem with the chicken. But because its anatomical features are more similar, we have a problem. I'm just trying to, just give me 1 second to move some tables. The first debate that occurred with the chicken was with the chicken right over here. I'm sorry, you can't see its head, right? Okay. Okay. Can you see its head now? Okay, and this bird is called a Polish chicken. And it's not called Polish because it's from Poland, although ironically it is from Poland. It's called Polish from the word Pol, whichever language, I think it's Dutch, which means head. But as you can see, it has very long feathers on its head. This bird is extremely halachically important. And it's halachically important for two reasons. First, it's very important because it is the first chicken which people debated as different than a regular chicken. The second thing that's important to note is we know exactly what kind of chicken they were talking about. You see, these chickens are not very hardy. They're beautiful. They're not hardy. And when you put them in a barn with regular chickens, they don't survive. And because of the difficulty in raising them, what ended up happening because of the difficulty raising these chickens is the only people who could raise these chickens were the nobility of Eastern Europe. And for those of you that have gone to the art museums, you know that the nobles of Eastern Europe used to have their paintings. And in their portraits, they would also often include the family pets. So there's a lot of paintings from the 1600s and the 1700s of people with their favorite chicken. And it looks exactly like the chicken that I have here. So we know that the chickens of the 1600s and 1700s that were called the Polish chicken look the same as the chickens that they're selling now as a Polish chicken. And the debate with the Polish chicken was a very interesting debate. You see these feathers on the head, those long feathers? The problem with those feathers is that fat deposits collect under those feathers and they cause the skull to degrade, and eventually there's going to be holes in that skull. And the Shiloh was in traphis, whether or not these chickens were traph because of the holes that developed in the skull. And what's interesting for our discussion here is that a number of the poskim noted as an aside, including the Simla Chadasha in his Sefer Tevuah Shor, that the Shiloh was only traphis, but everyone agrees this is a regular chicken. So this, when it appeared, when it was a Shiloh, the Shiloh is traphis, but everybody said as far as whether it's a kosher bird, everybody agreed that this chicken was a kosher chicken. And if you look at this chicken, you'll notice it's very different than the chickens I showed you before, the Plymouth Rock and the Rhode Island Red. Okay. The second Shiloh, can we see? Is this appearing? Can we zoom in on this chicken? The second Shiloh that really created a huge problem in Europe was the Cochin. This is a black Cochin. They come in all colors. Can we see it? Is it coming in on the, yeah, okay. And this bird, if you notice, it's a little bit different in shape. It has a lot of feathering on the feet. And of course, you can see what this bird looks like compared to the Plymouth Rock and the Rhode Island Red, which I showed you before. And interestingly enough, when this bird appeared in Europe, the majority of the first Rabbanim who saw it thought it was at least a problem. There were, in the 1830s, there were many shalos and tshuvos back and forth whether or not it was permitted. And the general consensus was that this chicken was a problem. However, because this chicken had a single feature, which is that it produced a lot of meat that was delicious, it got integrated into most of the chickens of Europe, which means that even though many Rabbanim felt this chicken was a problem, the offspring, the combination of this chicken with the other chickens was generally permitted. But going back to this chicken people thought was a problem, and this chicken, the Rabbanim were unanimously that there was only a problem with treifas. We have here another kind of a chicken, which is called the silky. And the silky, if you look at it, and the shocking thing is you're looking at it and you're saying, wow, they didn't do a good job preserving it. But this is actually what the bird looks like. They actually did a really good job. The reason why I don't have a live one is because I think that this one is such a good example, it's not necessary to keep a live one. But if you'll notice with the silky, it doesn't have feathers. The majority of its covering is, it's actually some kind of a feather, but it looks like fur. That's why it's called a silky. And these chickens were actually noted by Marco Polo, 1200s, an ancient breed. They have black skin and black meat. So if people were to get the real wontong soup, this would be the kind of chicken that they would use. Unfortunately, the Rabbanim currently have not determined whether or not this is a chicken. So we're not saying that it's not a chicken, but the Rabbanim have not agreed that it is a chicken. And both this bird and this bird are not certified by the OU, just to get the record straight. But this chicken, the offspring, are accepted as kosher. And this chicken, neither it nor its offspring are currently accepted as kosher. Okay. Now what we have here are a few interesting shilas. The first bird I have is, it's called a Japanese bantam. Can we zoom in on it? Now it looks like a pretty normal chicken. I mean, it's got the tail feathers that grow in the wrong direction. But it presents a halachic shila, because one of the things that people are probably thinking is, can't we identify a species based on how it breeds? So if I were to say that these chickens aren't a chicken, put it in the chicken house, see if they breed with regular chickens, and based on the breeding, try to determine if they're regular chickens or not. The problem is, because of the anomalies that have been preserved and the value of chickens with various anomalies, very often the breeding trick doesn't work. So for example, the Japanese bantams, even though they only survive if you make, you know, this one I bred myself, the rooster, the hen were both Japanese bantams, but the survival rate, the hatchability of the eggs, hovers about 25%, because there are lethal recessive genes in the DNA, and these lethal genes would just make it very difficult for these birds to breed. Of course, if the Japanese bantam was being raised commercially as a meat bird, it would not work out. Similarly, in the wild, this bird probably wouldn't be at a tremendous advantage. However, people are raising these birds as a curiosity, and as a result, they survive, but doing the normal test of do they breed isn't going to work, especially since, to start off, the chickens that we have, most of the commercial breeds, the commercial chickens, are so geared to regular breeding that they will mate with anything that they can, including other species, rabbits, whatever they can get their feet on. And the ability of the offspring to survive does not indicate that it's not necessarily the same breed. The way that Rav Belsky, Zichrono Livracha, paskind was that if you have two birds that breed together and the offspring have normal fertility, then we can assume that they're the same species. So that would mean that if we have two chickens that are very similar, everything breeds together nicely, that would be a good indication that they're both kosher chickens. But that trick doesn't work, well, not that psak doesn't work for most of the exotic chickens because they normally don't have normal fertility. So the fact that they breed with a regular chicken and the fertility is abnormal doesn't help clarify whether or not these are the same species. We have over here. This is the only rooster that I brought, so. Okay. We have a, whoops. Okay. We have a, okay. I'm just gonna step back. Alex, can you get a zoom in on the foot? So, yeah, okay. Good. Okay. Now this bird is very, I think, halakhically significant, but only marginally. I know, I said two things that are contradictory. You see, this bird is not real. What happened was, is that this bird, which is called a green-legged Polish fowl, and you could see, if the lighting in the room and the lighting on the camera cooperate, that the leg is actually a kind of green, a shade of green. But this bird is called a green-legged Polish fowl, but the green-legged Polish fowl basically went extinct. In 1939, and this is why it's halakhically significant, the Polish government did a poll of the birds of Poland, and 70% of the birds being raised in Poland were this kind of bird. Surprisingly, we don't have a single Shaila that talks about the color of these green legs, nor do we have any indication that anybody in Poland had any problems with this bird. But nonetheless, 70% of the birds of Poland were like this in 1939. After the Second World War, these birds were no longer as popular, and they sort of vanished. There's a number of universities in Poland which try to bring them back. I got a few eggs from them. They didn't have it looking perfectly the way I wanted to through selective breeding. Whatever, we were able to recreate the appearance of the bird, although genetically, this is not actually the green-legged Polish fowl that was consumed in Poland. Genetically, it's not, but at least the way it looks, it's the same bird. And what's important to look at with this bird is that it's not like the chickens that we have here. It's not like the chickens we have in America. And I'm not saying better or worse, but the idea is that depending on what the needs are, the birds change. And the chickens that you can get, there are hundreds and hundreds of breeds of chicken. They're all different. But what we do at the OU, you've got to wait. Okay. Give one more second. Come on, you're so good the whole presentation. Okay. Okay. What we did with this bird and what we've done with most of the birds that we know were consumed by people in Europe is we took it around to the elder Shochtim, we took it around to the elder Rabbanim who were in Europe, and we document whether or not this looks like the bird that they shechted, whether or not this looks like the bird they're familiar with. And based on that, we preserve it so that the future generations will know not only what bird we're consuming now, but also what birds were consumed traditionally in Europe and what the traditions were in Europe regarding kosher birds. Just want to put him away. That concludes the presentation on how we identify kosher birds. Again, for those of you that are joining us, if you're raising chickens in your backyard, you should know that not all breeds of chickens are acceptable. And of course, you have to be careful as far as the treifus if your chicken gets injured. We're now opening the forum to questions. Do we have any questions?
Yeah.
Turkeys.
Oh, okay, so we're not going to talk about turkeys because, as you can imagine, we don't have a strong tradition for turkeys going all the way back. So there are some rabbanim that avoid turkey, but the bottom line is that the reason that we accept turkey is because until the time of the Ramah, it seems that the tradition was to identify species not as clearly defined as we have it, which is by the way it breeds, but rather if they were similar with their internal kosher signs, the ones that I mentioned before, mentioned in Chul and Daf Nun Tes. So in the time when the turkey was accepted, presumably, the Rabbanim paskin that just like it had all the kosher signs, identical to that of a chicken, just like the chicken was kosher, the turkey wouldn't be kosher, would be kosher. And that goes back to what I was saying about the bird being predator. Because since a chicken's not predatory, since the turkey shared the kosher signs with the chicken, just like the chicken wasn't predatory, neither would be the turkey. And as you know, there are some Rabbanim that do not accept the turkey. Yeah?
Do ducks follow the same idea as geese?
Most. There are some ducks, such as the Muscovite duck, and there are some geese, such as the swan goose, which have similar but not identical beaks to the goose. That's why we have such a large goose. It's hard to handle, but I brought it in because we're very precise. If the beak is identical, if the foot is identical, that would be a problem. But there are a number of Rabbanim who were resistant to certifying or to allowing the Muscovite duck and the swan goose because it wasn't an identical beak and foot.
How do we know which eggs are okay?
So that's a good question. Generally, we have a very simple test, which is if the person who's selling you the eggs, whether they're Jewish or not, tells you this is, let's say, a chicken egg, and you've been eating chicken eggs your whole life, which means that you know what a chicken egg is, you don't need to have a certified chicken egg. And I'm saying this on camera from the very offices of the OU, which certifies the majority of the chicken eggs in America. But on the other hand, if you are not familiar with what a chicken egg is, or you want to buy an exotic egg, such as a quail egg, then you have to either be able to identify it, or it should be certified because you might confuse it. And I don't know where I put them. Oh, here. If you give me 1 second. We're not going to get it on camera, so I'm not going to try to, I don't know if they're too small. But we have kits that we send of quail eggs, because a lot of restaurants now are using quail eggs. And quail eggs, there are kosher quail, and there are other birds that are called quail, which are not, don't look like the quail we have here, but they, And before COVID, after COVID, we've been having trouble sourcing it. But we have this kit that we'll send, which is three different kinds of eggs, a kosher quail egg, a non-certified egg, and an egg from a different kind of quail, which does not look like the kosher quail. So if you're shechting, it's not a problem. And the restaurants can get these kits so that they can train their mashgichim to tell the difference between the eggs that are kosher and then those that aren't. However, if you do not have one of these kits and you do not know how to differentiate the kosher and the non-kosher quail eggs, the only way that you'll be able to know if the quail egg is kosher or if the duck egg is kosher is if it's certified by a kosher organization.
What's the OU's take on swans and peacocks?
So that's a very good question. So swans, the OU knows a very, very reputable and very respected families of Shechtim, which accepted the swan as kosher. However, the tradition of the OU is only to accept birds that were eaten by large, significant Jewish communities. So the fact that Choshev Rabbanim know that it's kosher, we don't accept the swan because it's individuals and not entire communities. Regarding the peacock, there's a phenomenal exhibit at the Bronx Zoo for those people that are in New York, where they have, at the end of the world of birds, they have an exhibit where they're breeding what's called the capercaillie. And if you look at the Rashi al HaTorah identifies the duchifat, one of the 24 forbidden birds. Rashi al HaTorah identifies as the duchifat, the hupu. This is the hupu. Rashi says hupu, and that's what we call it. And if you look at Israeli stamps, they also say this is the duchifat. This is the bird that's specifically forbidden in the Torah, one of the 24 forbidden species. However, the Rashi in Chulin identifies the duchifat as the capercaillie. And you can see them live at the Bronx Zoo. And if you look, the capercaillie, it sort of looks chickenish, But in any case, it's not a chicken, of course. The capercaillie, Rashi identifies it by its French name, which is pavon sauvage. And the, here you can look at it. It's pretty big, but it also is approximately the same size as a peacock. The problem is that Rashi identifies the peacock, the tavis, Rashi identifies the peacock, the tavis, as a pavon. So the Knesset HaGdola said, since we're not sure what Rashi meant by pavon and what Rashi meant by pavon sauvage, the best is to just avoid both of them. And the Knesset HaGdola suggested that we avoid the peacock as a result of this confusion. However, there were many shalos and tshuvos from North Africa, which were about treifos and peacock. So since they were asking shalos whether or not these peacocks were treif, it's pretty clear that they accepted the peacock as kosher. When Rav Belsky Zichron of Bracha was alive, we tried to find rabbanim from Morocco and from other major North African communities to clarify for us whether or not they could testify that the peacock was kosher. We were not able to locate those rabbanim. So at this current, we have to say at best the peacock is unknown, but historically there's a lot of evidence that it was accepted as kosher by a lot of the Jewish communities that lived in places where the climate was appropriate for raising peacock.
Okay, one more animal they want to ask about, ostrich.
So I don't know if you heard the boom, but I had ostrich eggs here, but it fell. So let me just, no, it didn't break. Okay, hang on. So this is the egg of an ostrich. The, first of all, you'll notice, for those of you that are into kosher eggs, the ostrich egg is round, on, does not have a kad v'chad. It's not a sharp edge and a wide edge. The ostrich egg has two sides that are both the same thickness. But the other thing about the ostrich egg is the ostrich, specifically the bas hayana, we have a tradition that's one of the 24 birds listed in the Torah is not kosher, and the bas hayana is identified as an ostrich. So it's listed in the Torah as not kosher. And the egg, despite falling, is a very strong egg, which is why the Mishnah talks about people who made kalim out of the egg, you know, made different kinds of vessels out of the eggs of the ostrich. All right, do you have any other questions?
It looks like there might be one or two more. Okay, this one's a long one. Aside from the specific non-kosher birds that are listed in the Torah, how do we know from a Masorah perspective that birds of prey are not kosher? This person doesn't recall, or he doesn't see in the perek that it specifically says birds of prey.
So that's an excellent question. The Gemara in Chulin, Daf Nuntes, discusses that specifically. And the Gemara, the Bali Tosfos, ask a very similar question, which is what is the basis for our rules and regulations in terms of having kosher signs or non-kosher signs for kosher birds. And the Bali Tosfos conclude that this was research that was done by Noach in the Teva. So it's actually this week's Parsha that Noach, when he came out of the Teva, he brought karbonos from all of the kosher birds. And one of the things he discovered were the anatomical features by which the kosher and the non-kosher birds could be differentiated. He knew what was kosher and what wasn't because he had to bring the appropriate number of animals into the teva, depending on if it was a kosher species or not. And what he realized was that there are four signs by which the kosher birds could be differentiated. And one of those, the first and foremost, and first thing he noticed is that none of the kosher birds were predators.
Okay, I never knew there were so many birds. Okay. The questions are right now, the emu,
we do not accept it as kosher.
Canada geese.
Canada geese we do accept as kosher.
And there was pheasant and muscovite.
Pheasant and muscovite we discussed.
I think
all right. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you again for Rebbetzin for putting it together. And thank you, Rabbi Ella, for making it happen.
Rabbi Larkey, that was quite an amazing presentation. We thank you and all of your feathered friends for joining us today. This was quite unbelievable. I think that everybody learned a lot, enjoyed it, and will probably never forget it. I certainly won't. So we thank Rabbi Loike, we thank Rabbi Elif, we thank OU Kosher, and of course Rabbi Ganak and the OU for letting us put all this together live in our headquarters. Next week, I want to remind everybody that our program continues next week with one of our other OU departments. Yachad is coming back for a second presentation. And it's, if you recall, we had a presentation in the spring. And now we're going to hear, Because Everyone Belongs, Ensuring that Individuals with Special Needs Are Included. So that'll be next Tuesday. And with your recording today, you will get registration for that program. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you, everybody, from OU Kosher.